Hello and welcome to Dyslexia Explored. I'm Darius Nomdaron and I have a guest that I'm really excited to interview. He lives in the tech world. He's a venture capitalist. He's dyslexic. He's trained as an attorney. He's been a litigator. He's been an intellectual corporate lawyer. He's also an electronic musician. He runs conferences like the, The Lobby. He's been very, you know, open about how dyslexia helps him and affects him in terms of remembering people's names, and also helps him in his work now as a venture capitalist. And I think this podcast will be really helpful for parents and teenagers who are thinking, oh, I'm interested in the tech world, and how would a dyslexic, someone with dyslexia, navigate the tech world and so on. So I'd really like to introduce you to David Hornick. David, it is great to have you on the podcast.
Yeah, it's amazing to be on the podcast, and it's daunting. I'm sort of scared to discuss these topics because I always feel, as most dyslexics do, like I have nothing. I have no unique insight, and others have done a better job of figuring out how to navigate these waters, but I'm really happy to tell my story and see if it's helpful to anyone.
Oh, that's great. I mean, I have to say I'm a little bit nervous myself too. I think I want to do a good job of this because I know a lot of, and the thing is, we're not here in Dyslexia Explored to find experts to teach us about dyslexia. That's not what we're looking for here. We're looking to hear people's real life stories. And then from their stories, we can sort of pick maybe a path for ourselves as well. And I think some of the children and teenagers and parents who listen to this, they're thinking, oh, my son does Minecraft or Lego and so on. And they're the type of person who builds stuff, who puts complex things together, and they're just perfectly suited for the tech world, quite frankly. They may not be the programmer who knows all the dots and T's and gets all the programming right, but they're the person who paints with people and puts the right people together, etc. And so I'm quite excited to hear your story. I don't know your full story. I've kind of binge watched quite a lot of videos and podcasts, and I'm becoming a fan of your content and your humor. So I'm looking forward to hearing it. And so I think that the guests will be really looking forward to it. So don't feel any imposter syndrome here.
All right. I'm ready.
You're ready. Okay. So David, actually, let's start with the end of the story before we start with the beginning. Okay. Yep. So why don't you tell the children and the parents that are listening a little bit about where you're at now? You know, you're a millionaire. You've got, you know, you own lots of parts of companies. Tell us a little bit about where you're at right now, and then we'll track the story from the beginning in your childhood to now.
Yeah, I somehow meandered my way to the perfect job. Now, it's the perfect job for me. I think in many ways it's an amazing job for dyslexics, but it was the perfect job. But it took a lot of trial. It took a lot of doing things, and it took a lot of helping people along the way. So they helped me along the way. And where I've landed is I'm now a venture capitalist. And venture capital, when I joined my current firm, which is now 20 years ago, I said to my mother, oh, I had been an attorney, and she understood what an attorney did. I'm like, oh, that's a respectable thing to do. You're an attorney, good for you. I said, hey, mom, I have a new job. She's like, oh, great, you're going to go be an attorney somewhere? No, I'm going to be a venture capitalist. What is a venture capitalist? Like, what is this thing you're doing? Which was totally fair, an absolutely fair question. And I said, well, it's kind of this job where you meet a bunch of interesting people. They're working on projects. And if you're excited enough about the project, you give them some money so that it helps them. And then you sit on their board and you give them advice. And as they make their way through, hopefully their companies do better. And if the company does really well and they make money, then you get to keep some of it. That's kind of the job. And my mother, we talked about it. My mother said, huh, that's perfect. You've talked your way into a job that only involves talking. And I said, yeah, that's right. And I didn't really appreciate at the moment how true that was, how true it is that my job is to talk to people, to gather information from people, to prioritize and assess it and figure out what I think is the future of technology and make some guesses and invest in companies. And when they work, and they rarely work, it turns out, but when they work, it's an amazing thing. It's an amazing, you know, truly creational, additive thing that they do. And I get to participate in it. And then thankfully, I also get to make money doing that. And that's been, that is a job, is to me a miracle and a perfect moment.
Fantastic. Okay, so we've got a picture of what you do, where you're at. So let's go back in time to hear your dyslexia story. And what was life like? Where did it all begin? What was life like before you realized you're dyslexic and had some difficulties? What was it like before then? Could you just share a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, what I have learned over time, although I didn't appreciate at the time, is that there's this moment in time when, by and large, you know, parents and kids figure out, oh, this is something is different here. And that's kind of what, second or third grade, you're 8 years old or 9 years old. But up until that time, you know, I have an older sister, I have a younger brother, and my parents were very supportive family, and it was very active learning kind of family, where you played logic games together, and we went to events and talked. It was a very talky house. There's a lot of talking in this house. It was also a house that loved books. My mother is a voracious reader. She's and loves books, and so it was a house that had you remember in the olden days, there were these things called encyclopedias, and you know, you had to buy this big book of knowledge. It wasn't all available on your phone. And so we are a house where if you were at dinner and someone asked a question that no one knew the answer to, you went to the encyclopedia and you looked it up. Oh, here's the answer. The mole rat is this. And here's what, you know. Anyway, so that was the kind of house I grew up in. I had a little brother who is the, you know, the least dyslexic person you've ever met. He's just a very, very, very high processing power individual, and very early on. And so he taught himself to read when he was very young. And so it was clear to me that he was better at that thing than I was. And so my answer to that was just to have him read to me. Like, I have this younger brother, and he by and large would do the things I told him to do. So I'll just have him do the things that I find less pleasant, like reading.
Delegation came early.
Very early, whether he liked it or not. And so anyway, we came along. I lived this life where it was a family of learners, where information and you know, intellectual curiosity were important and celebrated, even when you were little people. Mm. And I think that's important. I mean, as I now have 4 children who are, you know, grown kids. But I remember thinking, as they were kids and we were raising them, I'm going to speak to them like adults. I'm going to treat them like adults. And I'm going to teach them when they don't understand a thing to ask, to say, huh, what did that mean? Why is that the case? Whatever. Instead of saying, I'm going to assume you don't understand this, and I'm going to dumb down your world to the world you live in today. Why would you do that? I grew up in an aspirational world where the expectation was that you understood everything, and if you didn't, that you would ask the question.
So what was the wake-up call? What woke you up to the fact that you were dyslexic or that there was a difficulty or a difference?
Well, it was very clear, I think, to my mother, because she had two other children who read early, liked reading, had no issues with spelling. I mean, the number of conversations I can remember, I mean, I'm sort of tearing up thinking about it, of working through words. Like, no, David, you know, a B, I still have this issue, like, you know, B as in bed, you lie on the bed. And, you know, the one that to this day I laugh about is I was trying to learn the spelling to separate. And I kept misspelling it. And my mother was saying, there's a rat in separate. And I was like, I know there's a rat in separate, you know, S-E-P-E-R-A-T-E, separate, there's a rat in separate. And finally she realized, like, no, David, there's a rat in separate. And I was like, oh, it's a rat, fine, okay. The fact that I still, to this day, in order to understand how to spell separate, is to go to in my head to this moment in time with my mother, who was like, a rat in separate, oh, okay, now I get it, you know? Your principal is your pal. Oh, okay, gotcha. He's my principal. Fun. He's not my principal, right? These, you know, she was in it. So she wasn't confused. But the moment in time that it was clear was in third grade. I moved to a new school. In my new school, it turned out it was just sort of both a lucky and a surprising circumstance. We get to a new school. I have an older sister who's in fifth grade. I have a younger brother who's in first grade, and I'm in third grade. So we're all in the same school. And the school had what was called a gifted program, which was, these are the smart kids get to go to the gifted program. There was a teacher who would take you for some amount of time and push on the things that you could excel at. And my siblings and I arrive at the new school, and the teachers get to know us, and they immediately put my sister in the gifted program, and they put my brother in the gifted program. Mm. And my mother said, so David, have you heard about the, you know, like, when are you going to the gifted program? I said, I don't know what this thing is. And she said, what do you mean? It's like, what, of course you should be going. Like, she's sitting in her house saying, like, they're not different than you. So if they're in this program, clearly you should be in the program. So she marches to the school and says, hey, what the heck? Why are these two in the program, not this one? And the principal says, I don't know. I guess I'll ask his teacher. So yeah, you know, reaches out to the teacher, and the teacher basically said, yeah, he's smart. Like, you know, he's a talky little guy, and he has some things to say. But man, can that kid not spell, and that kid can't read, and that kid can't, you know, like, he's got real issues. Like, you know, he's a lot worse at a bunch of things that the smart kids aren't worse at. And so I was tested in a time when testing really wasn't a thing. And basically it was very top of the, you know, the testing scores in a set of processing things that you and I know dyslexics are good at. And then really bad in some of those things that, you know, that we're less good at. And so what was lucky is my mother said, okay, so there's some issues here, but he's still smart. Put him in the gifted program. And they did. They said, okay. And, you know, and that program said, hey, we got to figure out what's going on here, but just because you have these challenges doesn't mean you're not smart, not competent, not capable. Let's figure out how to make you successful in that context. And that was lucky. And so two things happened. One, it was clear, okay, you're different. And so you're going to have to come up with some coping mechanisms. And two, you know, to my mother, I got to focus some attention here if he's going to get through this. And that was true. All the way to college, she was in it, you know, kind of saying, what more help do you need so you can be successful, right?
Fantastic. So the wake-up call was this gifted program, and really, by the sounds of it, your mother. You know, your mother kept pressing on at that until there was a proper answer.
Yeah, she she wasn't accepting no.
Yes.
So it's like, okay, some of it is that I think my mother is your typical mother and she is delusional. And so therefore she's like, oh, my children are all brilliant. Like, look at these. So what do you mean this one isn't?
Yes.
Like, of course he is. And so that sort of, egocentric view of our family served me very well because, it turns out that as we all, as dyslexics or as parents of dyslexics, you should know, there are lots of skills that we have. There are lots of things that if we can unleash them, allow us to be really successful humans. But if you just put us in the typical path, they break us down, right?
Yeah.
They make it very hard.
Tell me, I find that school makes you feel stupid if you're dyslexic. And I think that a number of people who are dyslexic and have achieved great successes still feel a bit like an imposter, that they're maybe not quite as smart as, people think they are, because we kind of get that from school. I mean, I was doing this interview with a dentist, an award-winning dentist, highly intelligent. He was just about to do his dyslexia assessment in his 40s. And he said, look, I'll be honest with you. I'm scared that they won't say I'm dyslexic and then I'll actually be as stupid as I think I am. What's your take on all that? How did you feel during that process?
There's a flip side too, right? One is you're made to feel, like I said, smart. The world likes to think that smart people consume information by reading, right? Smart people are readers and they're writers and they're, and it is true. The human language is this incredibly important aspect of communicating with other individuals and all. And so you go through this, or math. I mean, ultimately you should be able to do this simple thing. If you're, I'm a letter dyslexic. I am fine with numbers, so I haven't experienced it, but I can imagine the same frustration when everybody else is like, how is this confusing to you? Here's a 10 and here's a 10 and it equals 20. And you're like, I don't even know what you're talking about, right? I read a sentence and I'm like, what? I don't even know what you're talking about. So there's a huge frustration in that. And I think that the fact that I've navigated it to end up in a position where I can get through the world where, by and large, no one knows that I'm dyslexic, right? By and large, you don't know. And so that's great. Good for you. And then I look at it and say, well, maybe I'm not. Maybe I'm, I'm this successful person. Maybe that was just a crutch, right? Maybe I was lazier. Maybe I should have worked harder at learning to read more quickly, right? I always say it doesn't matter what it is. I read about 10 pages an hour, right? That 10 pages an hour in law school was brutal. That was a lot of hours. And so I sit there thinking like, oh, maybe if I just worked harder, right? Maybe if I just applied myself in different ways, I could be a better speller, right? How hard is it to create a bunch of rules? Like if a rat and separate means you can read separate, maybe that's how everybody does it. And maybe I just haven't given myself enough heuristics, right? So I totally get that. To this day, I get that. Like,
yeah,
I think it's important for dyslexics to say, like, look at who cares? Who cares? Yeah. All that matters is that I've come up with a way to engage with the world that's successful for me, that allows me to be, to be my best self.
Tell the story about, you're a lecturer now at Harvard, is that right?
Both Harvard and Stanford.
At Harvard and Stanford. And when you stand up to lecture entrepreneurs and so on, you tell them something about spelling. I think that's fantastic. Can you share that with the audience?
Well, this is the thing, right? So you get this amazing validation. People say, okay, you have something to share with these very smart students. I teach at Stanford Business School and I teach at Harvard Law School. But I find this in particular at Harvard Law School, because the students who go to Harvard Law School are very, very book smart. Like, that is what they do. And they're also very judgmental. They're very quick to kind of judge you. And so I start teaching and talking about my experience and what I've done. But the first moment that I go to put pen to, you know, to the board, to write something, I stop and I say, I just want you to know that I'm dyslexic. And just because it's misspelled doesn't mean it isn't true. Yeah. And they kind of laugh like, oh, that's funny. But I think it's important, right? Because we've all experienced this. You get something and you look at it and it looks like it's from a stupid person because you're like, how could this be? How is this a written sentence from a smart person? And so you don't pay attention to the content. You're so busy focusing on the, you know, the edifice that you don't say, gee, I wonder if this is an intelligent thing.
Yeah.
You never get to it.
Yeah.
And that's unfair. And it's, and so luckily I'm in a position of authority. I get to say to them, do not look at the spelling, read the content, right?
I have that with my wife sometimes now still too. So I give her a piece of work that I've written on, you know, and she starts reading it. And I said, could you tell me what you think about this, you know? And she starts reading it. And you go, oh, you got this wrong, the spelling wrong. You got that. And I'm like, no. It's not about spelling. I want the content. Tell me what you think about the content. And it's incredibly hard for her to look past the mistakes that distract her from to the content. She's like, I can't see the content. It's like looking through a windshield with lots of bird poo on it. I can't see out because of all this stuff. And I'm like, no, just please look up, look past all of that. Just look at the content. She's learned enough. Okay, I'll look through the content. But it's I can see it in her that she's like, content.
Let me tell you this. Whether it was the genius of my mother or whether it was luck, we had an answer to this when I was a kid.
Oh.
Every paper I wrote, almost every paper, I wrote in it by hand. And I read it to her and she typed it. And it did two things, right? It got past the what is written is a mess, right?
Yes.
Because she didn't see it.
No,
she only heard what I said. So as long as I understood what it said and I spoke to her, she heard the concept. So, okay. And then she could say, is this the right word? Is this right? Deconstruct the sentence as a sentence, not as a string of misspellings or whatever, right?
Okay.
And I think it's a really valuable tool. And to this day, I read out loud to myself. I mean, my wife is constantly like, what? I'm like, I'm not talking to you because I'm sitting doing email and I'll type something. And if it's important, I always read it out loud to myself because then I can hear this. I don't know if this is uniquely me or if this is a dyslexic. I imagine this is a broadly dyslexic problem, but you talk to readers, they hear the words in their heads fluently. They kind of cook along and they hear it flowing through their head. Oh my God, I don't do that at all. I have to struggle to hear. I need all sound out. I need to be like in the tunnel if I'm going to try and translate the words on a page to language in my head. But if I say it out loud, it's like a megaphone into my brain. So
wow.
I speak out loud and I tell my kids to do this. And they're kind of, and you know, my oldest was diagnosed as a dyslexic when he was young and has navigated that very well. The other three seem to not have had that. But I still tell them all, like, if you want to understand whether something flows, whether you're making a point or whatever, you have to read it out loud. That's how you can hear it.
I'm the same. I have to, if I write something, I have to read it out loud to myself. And sometimes I even record myself reading it out loud. And then I listen to myself having read it out loud. And then I'm like, no, you know, and it's so time consuming. It's so tedious. It's so mechanical, but at the end of the day, you got to get the job done. And after time of trying to, I'll just skip past that, you start realizing I can't skip past this.
I'll tell you a story of an amazing young woman, amazing entrepreneur, who came to me one day. She had got introduced to me by a mutual friend. She had an idea to try and solve a big problem. And before we met, she sent me a blog post that she had written as context. And that night before I clicked on it, it was long. And I said, I'm meeting with her. I'm not going to read it. She can tell me about it. I get together with her. And the first thing she says to me is, so did you read my blog post? I said to her, I have to admit to you, I'm dyslexic. And when I clicked through to it, it was so long and daunting that I didn't read it. I apologize for that. But I'd love to know what the core concepts were, right? So she says, great, blah, blah, blah. We have a conversation. She leaves my office, and within 15 minutes, I receive a link to her reading the article to me.
Oh, wow.
And that was the moment when I would do anything for her. Like, because she said, oh, I hear what you're saying, and I understand this challenge. I'm going to do the thing that you need. That was amazing, right? So Sue Kim gets anything she needs from me for the rest of her life, for that one simple act of decency.
Wow. Wow. That's quite a moment. Like, you know, I heard you talking about judging people and how you did this little TED talk about forgetting people's names. And Stan Gloss was on the podcast a few podcasts back, and he was talking about the work of Brené Brown and how shame, you know, blocks us and imprisons us if we allow it to, and how much shame can come into the life of a dyslexic thinker, basically because of the school system, really, you know, how everything is so word-based and reading-based. And then that moment of empathy, when someone says, I see what you need, I see what you want, and responds to it, heals. And I can see that there. You know, I think she showed some empathy, and she showed it in terms of, well, if that's what you need, then I'll read it out to you.
Yeah. Yeah, it was amazing. It was, you know, it was just that moment when you realize there are some people who, you know, engage at a higher level. They hear truth and they solve problems, right?
Yeah, yeah. So the main challenge that you found in school was very much reading, okay? And it's not the case for every dyslexic, ironically. You know, like for some dyslexics, there's a lot of people who have dyslexia that actually they can read quite well, but their issue is with filtering information, focusing, staying on point, creating an essay outline or a story outline, bringing a story to a satisfying conclusion, staying focused, planning their day, etc. Now, it's listening to you just in this short while and before this, you know, yours seems to be very much in the reading and writing and spelling category, whereas actually there's you're pretty competent at these other areas, it seems, where often dyslexia shows up more. So would that be an accurate summary of yeah, what your challenges were?
There's one other I want to say, because I think this is hugely, this was, there was this moment in time, I don't know if you've seen, Phil Schultz wrote this book called My Dyslexia. It's this lovely little book. Phil Schultz is a poet. He was the poet laureate to the US. And, you know, periodically I attempt to read dyslexia books, which I do think is a little ironic. But anyway, I was reading My Dyslexia on a plane, weeping, just because it was so much my experience in lots of ways. And to this imposter syndrome thing, kind of validating about, oh, these are my, you know, these are the same experiences. And he had a sentence, and I don't remember the specific sentence, but it's something very close to, many dyslexics liken the study of foreign language to torture. And I was like, oh, thank God, right? The idea, this I am on a mission at Stanford. I'm not getting any traction on this mission, but I'm on a mission at Stanford. I'm on a committee that helps to influence the undergraduate curriculum, et cetera. And I have said repeatedly, the requirement of a foreign language is outdated and brutal for someone like me. And I don't know what that dynamic is, but I think it has the same thing to do with this idea of that names are impossible for me. And it's because they don't mean anything, right? I meet you and now you and I can't remember your name and I have apologized for that. But I certainly will always think when I'm seeing anything about Edinburgh of you, mm-hmm. right? That is a thing. It can make a connection. Whereas this abstract name that you have, I'm going online looking for it.
Do you go into your do you go into your phone and go Edinburgh podcast man, Darius?
100%.
Yeah.
All the time.
Yeah, but the thing is, Apple have changed their thing where they start showing people what you've put in as their name in the email. And you're like, oh no, I can't write crazy Edinburgh lady from Leith.
Exactly. I have it in the notes, in my contacts. My contact notes are, you know, introduced by so-and-so, went to such-and-such, crazy hat or whatever. And then you're like, oh, yeah, oh, great. Right. So the problem with foreign languages,
yeah,
I have to do that with every word.
Oh, yes.
Like every word. Yes. I ultimately studied German because my dad said, look, the good news about German is that every word is predictably spelled, right? If it's pronounced E, it's IE. If it's pronounced I, it's EI. And he's like, at a minimum, that will help you.
Yes. Yes. Have you heard of, this might help you with Harvard, is that if you're identified with dyslexia, you can replace your language requirement with sign language. So a lot of people some people allow this, and maybe Harvard could make it explicit, or sign language, foreign language or sign language, because the person learns the language, it's visual and it is a language, there's a grammar, there's a discipline, it can be tested, all the rest of it, it's got the same rigor, but it visually makes sense. They can imagine it, you know, like every single word has some sort of example.
What I have argued to the university is that computer science should count, right? That
it's a programming language. Wow.
And it's the same thing you're saying, like programming is just different, but programming I can do, because it's logic and it's concepts and whatever. It's hard because every so often you have a problem because you've written something incorrectly, but programming is a language and it has all the intellectual concepts that they should care about. But it's this outdated view of an intellect, right? That is, you should be able to speak another language. Raise something, you reminded me of something. This has been my saving grace, and it's my number one recommendation for kids with dyslexia.
Oh, great, tell us.
And I don't know if it applies to everyone. I think partially it applies because I was a musician. I am theoretically still a musician, but I was a musician. And so to me, right, I started out as a violinist and played other things. And so to me, there's this translation between the thing I'm trying to create and the physical world. And so this is a C and that, you know, whatever. Touch typing to me in many ways saved me, because suddenly words became a motion, not a thing. And, you know, not, oh, it's T-H-E, what are those words? It's this thing on the keyboard.
Yeah.
And once your fingers are trained that this is the motion that makes that word, it's different. It's a different thing. And so for a huge panoply of words that otherwise I would struggle with, they just have a finger motion that when I type, I don't even have to think about it. like your sign language, right?
Yes.
Sign means a thing to my brain that is different from let me understand how these letters interact and how and getting them mixed up. And so technology has really saved me in many regards because, first of all, I type and that translates it into this thing. And then the technology then gives me a little, you know, squiggly when it's wrong. And then usually you can kind of control whatever and it'll tell you here, which of these things did you mean? And you go, okay, great. But you and I and every dyslexic I know have had this experience where no version you put into the computer comes up with a recommendation that means the thing you mean, right? And yes. You're like, are you serious? I can't get close enough that the computer knows what I'm saying. That's just unbelievable. So then, if you're desperate for that word, usually what dyslexics then do is choose a different word. That sucks because the word you chose is the word you wanted, and words are different, right? If I meant, you know, gargantuan, I didn't mean gigantic. I meant gargantuan. I just wish I could spell gargantuan. Like, what is that spell?
Yes.
So then if you're desperate for that word, then go to Google and put your spelling in Google because Google is better.
Yeah.
And the vast majority of time, Google will then come up with the word you mean.
And it gets better now because you can go, Alexa, how do you spell gargantuan? And you can do it with your mouth.
Thank you for that. I had never done that, and that's exactly right. That's
amazing. You can do it with Siri as well. You can go into Siri and you say, hey, Siri, spell gargantuan. No, don't do it just now, Siri. Stop.
The idea that I had not thought of that, that you're just telling me this now and that it's like, oh, yeah, that's right, is unimaginable to me. Like, of course that's right. That is just that is so amazing. Thank you.
I live in a world where parents are constantly being asked by their kids, Mom, how do you spell gargantuan? And the parents dyslexic as well. And they're like, oh. And I was just speaking to Petrina, shout out to Petrina, who works in IBM, high up in IBM. And she's like, well, Siri, how do you spell gargantuan? And that's their solution. And you know, what's fascinating, like what's, I want to get into this whole world of tech and dyslexia, and let's get to the point where let's talk about tech and dyslexia, but let's close the story loop. So you had these challenges in high school. You ended up going to law school.
Yeah.
And you find it hard to read. How crazy are you? I went to law school as well, but I didn't know I was dyslexic. Yeah. I just thought I was faking being intelligent. But I ended up getting some of the highest grade. I was at the bottom of all my classes until I was 14. Until one teacher came up with me and he said, Darius, I think you're intelligent. And I said, my mom says I am. I don't think I am, really. I'm at the fifth bottom class with all the bad boys. He said, I think you just need to learn how the game is played. And I'm like, what do you mean? And he says, do you want to get an A? And I said, yeah, I want to get an A. And he said to me, well, shall I show you how you get an A? And I said, yeah, tell me the secret. And he says, well, you need to read this book by Tony Buzan, How to Use Your Head. And I was like, oh, God, okay.
Thanks for nothing.
And he said, but the bottom line is this, Darius. All you have to do is to tell me what I told you last week in the test. Do you get that? And if you tell me what I told you, you just write down what I said, something near it, I'll give you a B. I'm like, really? Now you see, he had figured out I was actually trying to understand what I was learning. I was actually trying to explain it back to him.
Yeah.
And he was like, you don't need to explain it. Just tell me that you were listening. And write it down to prove that you were listening last week, and you'll get a B. I'm like, really? And he said, I'll tell you what, if you connect it with something else that I said, maybe in a different week, I'll give you an A. I said, connecting stuff? I can do that.
I can do that.
And do you know what? Within 6 months, I was the top of every single class. No, I wasn't at the top of every single class, correction. I was at the top. I was in all of the top classes because my mum made sure I was. I ended up getting some of the highest grades you can get. I ended up going into law school, except I got a C in English. I wasn't good at the English. I couldn't play the game with English. And it was all maths. And you did the same thing. You used to write disclaimers at the end of your essays sometimes. I used to write them at the end of my essays as well. I would say, dear marker, I am really sorry. My writing is terrible. My spelling is terrible. I don't know why. I do care. And I do appreciate you had to wade through all of that. So please, you know, think kindly on me, you know? And so I overcompensated by putting more facts in. Why am I sharing all of that? Why?
Law school. I can't remember. I went to law school.
Law school. But I was playing the game. I was playing the system. And I hit a brick wall in third year where I dropped out. And then I went and became a joiner. I trained to be a joiner for 2 years. And then I came back and I finished my law degree. And that's when I learned how to organize my ideas visually and mind map. But how did you manage in law school?
So you have just described how I've managed in everything.
Okay.
Which is, my poor children have had to listen to this. I say, like, look at, you can think of school two ways. One is I'm learning a bunch of stuff. And the other is I have to go to school because this is a required step to be a successful human. I said, and it turns out that you need to get good grades because that's a requirement to this thing. But it's just a game, right? It is a game. The process of getting good grades is not an indication of your intellect. It's not whatever. And so what you need to do is understand what is important to these teachers. Every teacher is different. Every class is different. But what is important? And I said, and first and foremost, you have to remember that teachers are human beings. And if they like you, they would rather you be successful. And if they dislike you, they don't care if you're successful. So start there. Start by making sure they actually care if you're successful or not. You had a teacher who actually cared, and so he went out of his way. So for me, it was, you know, step one was, how am I going to connect with this human? Because this human gets to judge me, and I need you to be on my side. And then step two is, so what is it that matters to you and how can I make sure to do that? And so most of the time that's easy. Most of the time you kind of go, oh, okay, I know what matters to you. And some of the time what matters to them is something that's really hard for you. And that's like, oh man, I don't know. So here's a great example in law school. My first year of law school, I just had to work hard. Right. I just needed to read everything because I didn't know I didn't know how they were measuring you. I didn't know what was important. There was a lot of mythology. And so I just worked really, really hard. And I have to say, I was talking with a mom of a dyslexic child and I made her cry and I felt badly. But one of the things I said to her was, dyslexic kids have to work harder. Like it is harder. It's harder. It doesn't mean that it's not a death sentence. It's not, but there are challenges. And some of the time you just have to do the work. You just have to take the time. And is that fair? Like, no, it's not fair at all. It's horrible. It's unfair. But my first year of law school, I just said, I got to do the work here. If I read 10 pages an hour, that's so be it. And I've been assigned 200 pages. I got 20 hours ahead of me. Like, so settle in, right? But I had one law school class. I had a roommate in law school who's a brilliant human. And again, sort of like my little brother, is the least dyslexic human, like the most whatever. And I told him my strategy for my property class. And he thought I was insane. I said, I have a take-home exam for this professor and I just pre-wrote an essay. I spent the day writing an answer to an essay question. He said, oh, did he give you the questions? I said, no, but I know what he's going to ask. And my friend was like, that is the stupidest thing I've ever heard. What, you've just wasted a day, whatever. And I said, but if I'm right, there are going to be three essay questions and I now have the whole time to do two of them. He said, yeah, and if you're wrong, you've lost a day studying. I said, yeah, I'm not wrong. And sure enough, because I paid attention in class, this professor was obsessed with this particular social justice view of whatever. And so it's a take-home exam. And my friend Steve is in his bedroom next door. And I get the take-home exam. And he hears me go, yes! Because all I had to do was change the introductory paragraph. And the remainder of it was dead on. And that then gave me all this extra time to do the other stuff, which was incredible, right? That was an incredible gift. So a lot of it is understand the psychology, trying to understand what matters and what's going to be asked of you. And, you know, and so I got better grades each of my years in law school. I ended up graduating magna cum laude. Because I figured out what did professors need for you to get great grade. Now here's one more story that makes me, so you say, okay, well then David, maybe you're not, then you never engage with anything on a deep level because you are just trying to game the system. And so you never, turns out that's not really true, because if you're excited about something, right, then you dig in. And so I loved intellectual property law. I thought it was really fun and engaging. And so I by the time I got to the intellectual property exam, I knew it so well because I just thought it was fascinating. Mm. And the question comes in, and it was, you know, typical law school class question, but it was kind of a fun question. It was like, so-and-so is a famous architect who designed this amazing house. And this company has made a doghouse that looks just like this famous house. Discuss the intellectual property issues, right? And so I look at that, oh, that's such a great question. And I start my first sentence. Well, of the answer was, in the dog-eat-dog world of architecture, blah. This then causes me to go like, oh my God, this is so great. And so in the course of answering this question, which was an intellectual property question, I included like, I don't know, 25 dog references. I included his bark was worse. You know, if they sue you for this, their bark is worse than their bite. If the blah, blah, blah. Like it was just... it was so fun. Like, and I'm sitting there writing the exam while scribbling down dog references so I can get them in the question later, right? And I finished and I had lots of time, and it's the only exam I ever went back to look at the professor's response. And the professor had check marks next to the legal issues and made no reference to the fact that this essay included 25 dog references. Not a ha, not a thanks, I was so angry. But I have to say, it was the best answer I've ever written in any exam ever. I got an A because I knew the subject, but he totally missed it. He missed all the fun.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I had a law professor at Edinburgh who did contract law. And he was a genius. And you know, when you get these lecturers who just are standout geniuses, and a standout genius professor is someone who can take something complex and make it simple without dumbing it down. Mm-hmm. And that's what he did. And we were all in awe of him. And he had this reputation of doing interesting exam questions, really well thought out. So for his contract law, he said, in the story of Jack and the Beanstalk, who owns the golden egg?
Yeah.
And he said, And he did the story. You know, Jack went out and he exchanged this cow. He threw it out the window and it landed into another person's property. The vine grew up on another person's property outside his window. He went up to the giant. He stole the golden goose. He went down and the goose was in his house and it laid the egg. Who does the egg belong to?
That's such a good question.
And it's just a genius question with case law. Boom, 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 boom. All of the things, you know. And there's a straightforward answer to it with Scottish case law, you know. And it's fantastic. Anyway, that's what makes you excited about really learning and applying it. And back to your question. So going back, actually, let's just get something out of this for those children who are learning, those parents who are learning, that's directly applicable. So you have to understand the game you're playing. Mm-hmm. You need to, and what I'm hearing from you, and I've taught students this before, is like, you need to know the rules of the game. You know, where is the boundary of the pitch? Where is the goal? Where are the goalposts? Where are you on the pitch? Where have you got to get the ball in, etc.? You know, don't just show off that you can run super fast and you can dribble the ball all over the place. That's not what we're interested in. We're interested in, can you get the ball from here into that goal past those people? Yes, then you've got the result. But you've brought something else into the mix. You know, there's the rules of the game. But this ties, I think, into the venture capitalism is, you need to not just play the ball within the rules, you need to play the person. Yep. Not against them, but it's about the relationships. You know, it's like, you know, the referee, you know, does the referee look and see, are you trying to cheat here or was that a mistake? You know, and you know, I think that's what I'm taking away from this. The importance of the people that are in this dynamic, it's not just, you have to prove everything that you know on something, etc.
And it's true in everything, right? It's true in everything. People make mistakes, and the mistakes can be viewed as pernicious or they can be viewed as mistakes, right? Right? If you love your doctor and the doctor makes a mistake that causes harm, you're probably less likely to sue them for malpractice, right? If I'm engaging in a negotiation with someone and we have a genuine relationship, we don't try and, you know, screw the other person. You try to come to a mutually agreeable positive outcome because you have a relationship and you care about each other. And then the other thing that's important is long-term relationships matter. Because the benefit of the doubt for a long time. You get to engage, right? So when you find someone who understands you and appreciates you, spend more time with them, right? And this is easier in college, it's easier in law school, right? If you have someone who understands and appreciates you, take their classes, take more classes, right? When you have someone who is this teacher who you love, go to their office hours. When you have an elementary school teacher who has helped you, you know, go back and visit them at recess, right? Mm. Those relationships, the people who are net positive in helping you to navigate this world in a world which is challenging, they, you know, the ones who understand you and are on your side are disproportionately valuable to dyslexics. You need allies to help you get through to navigate the planet. And when you find great allies, understand that that is a gift, right? And it's a gift that you have to, you know, you have to nurture and you have to thank them and you have to be sure that that's a long, long, long-term relationship.
Yeah, that reminds me of the podcast we just did with Mickey Boaz when she was talking about cutting through the red tape of dyslexia in school, that making your teacher, becoming a partner to your teacher, you know, like really partnering with them rather than it's a them and us, you know, you're coming alongside them right from the beginning. And Yeah, that's so true. Because actually, sometimes you can, I often think you've got the school system and you, and the difficult, and you can look at the school system and you can say the school system is wrong and it's bad. And then the teachers get painted in that. But actually, what I think is that there's the school, and schooling is good, but often the system that they use to teach you how to read or how to organize your thoughts or to plan or to present something or share, it is not good. It can be better. And you can choose to change a system for yourself. You can change your system of learning how to read, reading comprehension, you know, absorbing information, sharing your ideas, etc. You can choose that system. You don't need to change the whole system. Neither do you need to change the school, although the system needs changed for the wider society. But that means that the school and the teachers can still be your ally. So there's you and the teachers and the school are your ally. All you need to do is change that middle bit, which is the system for you.
And if the teacher's on your side, and if you're partnering with that teacher, it might happen. If they aren't, it's not going to happen. Like that's, you know, the degree of difficulty of you against everyone is so dramatic compared to, you know, you and a partner trying to figure out the best path forward.
So I'd really like to talk about tech. And I think a lot of people would really love to hear your perspective of dyslexia in tech, dyslexia in the tech world. I reckon a lot of people in the dyslexia tech world are dyslexic. But let's keep closing this loop, because you said something. You start working with people. This challenge, a lot of it was about reading what the professor wanted, finding out what people want and figuring that out, and reading the situation and predicting the situation. You went into law school with that. You went into law with that. And you actually found that you ended up into venture capitalism, which actually is all about predicting what would happen, working with what people need and want, etc. So in many ways, a lot of those challenges you faced were training you in certain skills that you're now capitalizing on, literally, in venture capital. So let's talk a little, could you translate that into what's now? And for the teenagers who are listening to this, those skills you learned in school, translating them up into in school, in law school, in the law firm, and you're translating it into the venture capital. Talk to us a little bit about dyslexia in the venture capital world, dyslexia in tech, whatever.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are a huge number of dyslexics who are working in the tech world, and in particular in the entrepreneurship world. And the reason that they're entrepreneurs is because if you're an entrepreneur, you get to make your own rules, right? You get to your point earlier about what's the field. You get to pick the field. You get to pick the rules. You get to pick the players. You know, you get to do all these things that you control that otherwise is hard. Like sometimes you have to, you know, you need otherwise to work with people on their playing field. And I guess you had some of this talking with others who've been in corporate America. In the startup world, it's just you. And you're trying to solve a problem. And if you try and solve a problem in kind of this traditional way, you're not likely doing anything that's terribly breakthrough, right? So in some ways, by having a brain that naturally thinks differently, it's a good thing. It's helpful to you to try and solve these problems that you're tackling. So I think entrepreneurs who are dyslexic have a lot of advantage, and they can choose how they communicate. They can choose what their world is, but it depends on the entrepreneur. I'm on the board of one company that everything is in writing and everything is communicated. It's this very big distributed company. And so the way they stay in touch is that everything's in writing. And I said to the CEO, "You're killing me. Like this company is so hard for me because my way of engaging is that things are spoken, that I gather information from humans." The thing that has been so valuable to me as a venture capitalist is that that my everyday is having very, very smart people who care very deeply about what they're doing tell me about it. Tell me what they're working on. Tell me why it's important. Tell me how they're building it. And then I get to ask questions, right? I then, if I think it's interesting enough, I get to say, well, what about this? Or how about that? Or how do you think about this? Or whatever. And so you get, you know, when you read a book, you're at the mercy of the author. They might tell you the answer in the first 20 pages, but they might meander their way to 1,000 pages before you get to the idea. And that is my nightmare, right? But when you are talking to entrepreneurs and they are pitching a business, they're describing what they're doing, you get to dictate the story arc. You get to say, why is this the case? Why have you chosen to do this? Explain these things. Let me cut to the end because I want to know about this thing. Oh, that's interesting. Here's the real challenge. Let me ask you about that. And so it's the dyslexic's dream, right? I don't need to do anything but engage with another human and have them share their information and then ask them the hard questions until I understand what they're doing in a way that I can put in the context of everything I've done before. And then I get to make a decision. Is this going to be a big, interesting company? Is this going to be a big, interesting idea or not? I don't always get it right. I have managed to turn down some of the most important businesses ever built. But you only have to get it right some of the time. You have to
find which ones have you turned down that you regret?
Well, I turned down the first venture capital investment in Uber, in Twitter, in, you know, Palantir, in, you know, a bunch of very interesting businesses that went on to be big, important businesses. But you know, you can't get them all right. You can't get it right all the time. What you have to do is find amazing people who you think are solving hard problems and help them solve those problems. Go work with them and help them solve those problems.
What was the one you got right the most?
Probably a company called Splunk. And Splunk is basically a search engine for data. And I spent time with these very smart founders, these three founders who were working on an idea. And they said, wouldn't it be great if you had the equivalent of Google for log files when systems break down, right? Because computers often break down. They stop doing what they were supposed to do. And then you have to figure out what went wrong. And there were no good tools really to figure out what went wrong. And these folks said, I use Google to answer every other question. Why is it that I can't use Google to answer the question, what went wrong with my computer systems? I said, that to me, that made abundant sense. And they spoke with a bunch of friends of mine who solved these problems, all of whom said, yeah, that makes a bunch of sense. So I gave them their first money and I helped them to, you know, to build a team and build a business and build software. And that, when I funded them, there were three people, and now there are thousands of employees, and it's a very, very big, valuable company now. And it does really important stuff. It actually makes the world's computer systems work better, and that's pretty exciting, right? From three guys and an idea to something that every service you use today that you love, whatever it is you know, functioning better because of this company, Splunk. That's amazing.
Yeah, fantastic. So, David, I could talk so much more to you, but I think this is the end of our podcast time. But I was going to ask you what your most influential learning moments, and it sounds like it's actually those 1,500 entrepreneurs that you've spoken to in these pitches where you can hear them and listen to them, which has been fantastic. And then a big question is, what advice would you give to your teenage self? You've been quite emotional sometimes in this podcast, and I really appreciate you being vulnerable like that. But if you could go back and speak to yourself and send yourself a card in time that had a message on the front of it, what would that message on the front of the card say? And what would the message inside the card say?
It would say, invest in Facebook.
Fantastic.
You know, it's...
Okay, invest in Facebook on the front. Great, we nailed that. What would it say on the inside?
Yeah, you know, what is interesting to me is that I often talk with people, I say, would you go into law school again? Would you do these things? But it's all worked out so well. Like, I sort of feel like it's worked out great. And it's and the journey has allowed me to be who I am and to see where I am. And so, you know, there's this temptation to send myself platitudes. It's going to be fine, or you're going to be whatever. But I always thought it was going to be fine, right? I actually don't think I'm very, very lucky. I just didn't need to send myself that message. I didn't need the message.
Okay, like, brilliant.
I had, and you and I talked about this earlier, and I described it a bit, but, you know, it really, I was very lucky. I had a family who did not, you know, who basically were like, look, you're you, but good on you. Keep at it, right? No one ever said like, well, maybe you're not up for it, right? No, I think there was always an expectation like, oh, you're going to go be successful. Whatever you choose to do, great, go do it. But do it well, work hard at it, be the very best you can be. But why wouldn't you be able to do that? Oh, well, you know, because I can't read or whatever. Ah, how is that a problem?
Fantastic. David, it has been fantastic to have you on the podcast, and I'm sure the parents and teenagers who listen to this will love it. Thank you very much.
No, thanks for having me. I think it's the most I've cried on any podcast, so I think that's a good thing.
Thank you for being so vulnerable. We'll put some links in the show notes to some of your other videos and so on, talks that you've done, like that talk on how you forget people's names, that talk on by Dyslexic Advantage about your story, and lots of interesting talks in there. We'll put some of those links in. Is there anything else that you would recommend to people, you know, to connect with anything that you've got, blogs, posts, whatever, books? Have you written any books?
Right, what books do you recommend? No, you know, look, I think there's a lot out there. I have tried, I started the first venture capital blog many years ago with some friends, and I just think, look, the best you can do is share what you know and engage with people. And so there's lots out there. If you search David Hornick, I have conveniently, other than P. David Hornick, the Israeli journalist, it's a unique name. So you'll see everything you need to see.
Okay, great. And I'm sure there might be some teenagers who grew up with dyslexia. They've got some great ideas, and they've probably got some tech idea and so on. You're the guy to... Awesome. Give a call to and see if they can pitch their idea to you.
Hornick@augustcap.com. You know how to find me.
Great. I bet you there's some of the listeners to this podcast that will come up with some good ideas in the next 10 years.
Great.
This podcast is brought to you by Bullet Map Academy. We help children organize their thoughts creatively and unlock their dyslexic potential with the world's first online dyslexia school for study skills. Thank you for listening. Please like and leave a podcast review so other parents can find it. Visit our website and join our newsletter for updates at bulletmapacademy.com. Thanks for listening. See you next time.